June 10th, 1940, Charlottesville, Virginia. The President of the United States addresses the graduating class of the University of Virginia, which includes his son, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr. Late last night, the White House announced the presidential address as an important message concerning the international situation and the World War. The President has just risen, and you can hear the applause from this 2,000 students and parents packed in the gymnasium here at the University of Virginia. President Roosevelt will be presented by Dr. John Lloyd Newcomb.
His Excellency, the President of the United States.
President Newcomb, my friends of the University of Virginia, I noticed by the program that I am asked to address the classes of 1940. I avail myself of that privilege, but I also take this very happy occasion to speak to many other classes. Classes that have graduated through all the years. Classes that are still in the period of study. Classes not alone of the schools of learning of the nation, but classes that have come up through the great schools of experience. In other words, a cross-section just as you who graduate today are a cross-section of the nation as a whole. Every generation of young men and women in America has questions to ask the world. Most of the time, they are the simple but nevertheless difficult questions. Questions of work to do, opportunities to find, ambitions to satisfy. But every now and again in the history of the Republic, a different kind of question presents itself. A question that asks not about the future of an individual or even of a generation, but about the future of the country, the future of the American people. There was such a time at the beginning of our history, as a nation. Young people asked themselves in those days what lay ahead, not for themselves, but for the new United States. There was such a time, again, in the seemingly endless years of the war between the states. Young men and young women on both sides of the line asked themselves not what trades or professions they would enter, what lives they would make, but what was to become of the country they had known. There is such a time again today. Again today, the young men and the young women of America ask themselves with earnestness and with deep concern this same question. What is to become of the country we know? Now they ask it with even greater anxiety than before. They ask not only what the future holds for this republic, but what the future holds for all peoples and all nations that have been living under democratic forms of government, under the free institutions of a free people. It is understandable to all of us, I think, that they should ask this question. They read the words of those who are telling them that the ideal of individual liberty, the ideal of free franchise, the ideal of peace through justice, is a decadent ideal. They read the word and hear the boast of those who say that a belief in force directed by self-chosen leaders, is the new and vigorous system which will overrun the earth. They have seen the ascendancy of this philosophy of force in nation after nation, where free institutions and individual liberties were once maintained. It is natural and understandable that the younger generation should first ask itself what the extension of the philosophy of force to all the world would lead to ultimately. We see today, for example, in stark reality, some of the consequences of what we call the machine age, where control of machines has been retained in the hands of mankind as a whole. Untold benefits have accrued to mankind. For mankind was then the master, and the machine was the servant. But in this new system of force, the mastery of the machine is not in the hands of mankind. It is in the control of infinitely small groups of individuals who rule without a single one of the democratic sanctions that we have known. The machine in the hands of irresponsible conquerors becomes the master. Mankind is not only the servant, it is the victim too. Such mastery abandons with deliberate contempt all of the moral values to which even this young country for more than 300 years has been accustomed and dedicated. Surely, the new philosophy proves from month to month that it could have no possible conception of the way of life or the way of thought of a nation whose origins go back to Jamestown and Plymouth Rock. And conversely, neither those who spring from that ancient stock, nor those who have come hither in later years, can be indifferent to the destruction of freedom in their ancestral lands across the sea. Perception of danger, danger to our institutions, may come slowly, or it may come with a rush and a shock, as it has to the people of the United States in the past few months. This perception of danger, danger in a worldwide area, it has come to us clearly and overwhelmingly. We perceive the peril in this worldwide arena, an arena that may become so narrowed that only the Americas would retain the ancient faiths. Some, indeed, still hold to the now somewhat obvious delusion that we of the United States can safely permit the United States to become a lone island in a world dominated by the philosophy of force. Such an island may be the dream of those who still talk and vote as isolationists. Such an island represents to me and to the overwhelming majority of Americans today a helpless nightmare, the helpless nightmare of a people without freedom. Yes, the nightmare of a people lodged in prison, handcuffed, hungry, and fed through the bars from day to day by the contemptuous, unpitying masters of other continents. It is natural also that we should ask ourselves how now we can prevent the building of that prison and the placing of ourselves in the midst of it. Let us not hesitate, all of us, to proclaim certain truths overwhelmingly We as a nation, and this applies to all the other American nations, we are convinced that military and naval victory for the gods of force and hate would endanger the institutions of democracy in the Western world, and that equally, therefore, the whole of our sympathies lie with those nations that are giving their lifeblood in combat against those forces. The people and the government of the United States have seen with the utmost regret and with grave disquiet the decision of the Italian government to engage in the hostilities now raging in Europe. More than 3 months ago, the chief of the Italian government sent me word that because of the determination of Italy to limit, so far as might be possible, the spread of the European conflict, more than 200 million of people in the region of the Mediterranean had been enabled to escape the suffering and the devastation of war. I informed the chief of the Italian government that this desire on the part of Italy to prevent the war from spreading met with full sympathy and response on the part of the government and the people of the United States. And I expressed the earnest hope of this government and of this people that this policy on the part of Italy might be continued. I made it clear that in the opinion of the government of the United States, any extension of hostilities in the region of the Mediterranean might result in a still greater enlargement of the scene of the conflict in the Near East and in Africa, and that if this came to pass, no one could foretell how much greater the theater of the war eventually might become. Again, on a subsequent occasion, not so far ago, recognizing that certain aspirations of Italy might form the basis of discussions between the powers most specifically concerned, I offered in a message addressed to the chief of the Italian government to send to the governments of France and of Great Britain such specific indications of the desires of Italy to obtain readjustments with regard to her position, as the chief of the Italian government might desire to transmit through me. While making it clear that the government of the United States, in such an event, could not and would not assume responsibility for the nature of the proposal submitted, nor for agreements which might thereafter be reached, I proposed that if Italy would refrain from entering the war, I would be willing to ask assurances from the other powers concerned that they would faithfully execute any agreement so reached, and that Italy's voice in any future peace conference would have the same authority as if Italy had actually taken part in the war as a belligerent. Unfortunately, to the regret of all of us and to the regret of humanity, the chief of the Italian government was unwilling to accept the procedure suggested, and he has made no counter-proposal. This government directed its efforts to doing what it could to work for the preservation of peace in the Mediterranean area. And it likewise expressed its willingness to endeavor to cooperate with the government of Italy when the appropriate occasion arose for the creation of a more stable world order through the reduction of armaments and through the construction of a more liberal international economic system. Which would assure to all powers equality of opportunity in the world's markets and in the securing of raw materials on equal terms. I have likewise, of course, felt it necessary in my communications to Signor Mussolini to express the concern of the government of the United States because of the fact that any extension of the war in the region of the Mediterranean would inevitably result in great prejudice to the ways of life and government and to the trade and commerce of all the American republics. The government of Italy has now chosen to preserve what it terms its freedom of action and to fulfill what it states are its promises to Germany. In so doing, it has manifested disregard for the rights and security of other nations, disregard for the lives of the peoples of those nations which are directly threatened by the spread of this war, and has evidenced its unwillingness to find the means through pacific negotiation for the satisfaction of what it believes are its legitimate aspirations. On this 10th day of June 1940, the hand that held the dagger has struck it into the back of its neighbor. On this 10th day of June, 1940, in this university, founded by the first great American teacher of democracy, we send forth our prayers and our hopes to those beyond the seas who are maintaining with magnificent valor their battle for freedom. In our unity, in our American unity, we will pursue two obvious and simultaneous courses. We will extend to the opponents of force the material resources of this nation. And at the same time, we will harness and speed up the use of those resources in order that we ourselves in the Americas may have equipment and training equal to the task of any emergency and every defense. All roads leading to the accomplishment of these objectives must be kept clear of obstructions. We will not slow down or detour. Signs and signals call for speed, full speed ahead. Yes. It is right that each new generation should ask questions. But in recent months, the principal question has been somewhat simplified. Once more, the future of the nation, the future of the American people, is at stake. We need not, and we will not, in any way abandon our continuing effort to make democracy work within our borders. Yes, we still insist on the new need for vast improvements in our own social and economic life. But that is a component part of national defense itself. The program unfolds swiftly. And into that program will fit the responsibility and the opportunity of every man and woman in the land to preserve our heritage in days of peril. I call for effort, courage, sacrifice, devotion, granting the love of freedom. All of these are possible. And the love of freedom is still fierce, still steady in the nation today.
And so the President of the United States concludes his address to the 115th graduating class of the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, Virginia, a class that included his son, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr. An audience of some 2,000 students, faculty, and friends of the university were seated in the Memorial Gymnasium as the President delivered this address of international significance. Behind us now, you can hear these 2,000 delivering an ovation to the President as he puts his clapboard back on his head and in a moment will leave the platform. This concludes the broadcast from Charlottesville, Virginia.